Welcome to a special program featuring stories by people from the community of Castine, Maine, recorded on September 25th, 2025. The event was co-sponsored by the Wilson Museum and WERU Community Radio, with generous support from the Maine Humanities Council. Our host was Georgia Zildjian of the Wilson Museum, who introduced the local storytellers. Special thanks to Lizzie Peabody, who coached and coordinated the storytellers.
Hi, everyone. Yay, it's on! Welcome to the Wilson Museum. It's so good to see so many of you. Thank you for your patience while we gathered more seating for you. We are here tonight gathered to hear these stories at the Wilson Museum, which is located in the homeland of the Penobscot Nation and their Wabanaki relations. This event is co-produced with WERU Community Radio and with Lizzie Peabody. And I'm going to welcome Lizzie up here to do a short introduction for you. So.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out on this dreary, cold night for an evening of live storytelling. I want to prepare you all for what you're going to hear. This is an evening of true stories. There are many kinds of stories, but all of these stories are true. They really happened to the people who are going to be speaking about them. And that is a brave and vulnerable thing to do, to come up here and share a story that means something to you. And so part of storytelling is the telling, but the other part is you, the audience. There really is no storytelling without an audience. And so your job is to just listen with as much openness as possible and know that you are also an integral piece of this exchange, this coming together. And thank you for choosing to spend your evening here. I do want to ask that everybody silence their cell phones. Just take a moment. Take it out, double check, because you don't want to be that guy or gal. Yeah, I just love to see people actually checking, and it never hurts to double check. Okay, I'm going to turn the evening over to Georgia. She is going to introduce our first storyteller, and thank you all so much for coming.
Right. So our first storyteller we have for you tonight is Joanna Sweet, and she is a resident of Castine and a lifelong educator and learner. She's an author, a poet, and a storyteller, and she's active in the Castine community and is grateful for the arts energy and support in this community. Please join me in welcoming Joanna.
All right. Good. Good evening. It was 1959. I was 9 years old, living on the North Shore in Huntington, Long Island. And I lived there in a small house with my mother, my father, and my older brother, who was older by 2 years than I was. And you might have thought, this is a pretty idyllic place. You're just above Huntington Beach, kick the can every summer night, the Good Humor Man, it's great. But I was kind of tired of being the little sister, little me too. I wanted to be one of the big kids. And on this day, July 5th, I had a plan. As I left my house early in the morning, barely closing the door, barely making a noise, "I'm going out," I called, and then made sure there was no slam the way there usually was in my mother's mantra, "Don't slam the door," after my brother or I had left. I headed down the stairs because my plan relied on stealth. Down 72 steps from the house to the street below, and then one more hill would take me to the beach and the gate that led in. I was down there, no one following me. That was good. Not a sound, people barely awake, I suspected, but there I was looking, scanning the beach for scuffled places, for craters in the sand, or where you might have seen some footprints of people racing away. What was I looking for? Firecrackers. Now, the bigger boys, I mean the really big boys, the teenagers, would go to the beach on the 4th and then light off these strings of match-sized firecrackers strung together, and they would go rat-tat-tat-tat through the night like machine gun fire, but an occasional firecracker would be flung free. and whoever was first at the beach that next morning could gather a fortune in firecrackers. So I began looking around. There would be one halfway in the sand, another lying there, visibly waiting for me to pluck. And I went from scuffle place to scuffle place to scuffle place, gathering, filling my pocket. And then I heard, "Hanny, what are you doing?" Oh, that was a stupid question. "What are you doing? You getting firecrackers?" "Maybe." "Well, what are you doing that for? You don't even like firecrackers." He was right. Any article my mother ever saw in the local Long Island Rag that said child blinded playing with firecrackers or Leavittville kid loses half a finger, I knew anything that befell any child in the past would befall me if I tried to light off a firecracker. "So how many have you got?" I pulled out a handful of these gems. Tommy, my brother's sidekick, another 11-year-old, had come down the hill with him. "How many did you find yet, Tommy?"
"3.
Okay. "Look, Hanny," my brother pulled a shiny quarter out of his pocket. "I'll buy them from you." That didn't deserve an answer. "I'm going home now," I said, turned and started headed up the hill. "Tommy, how many have you got?" "1 more." "Hanny, wait. So they began following me as I headed up Harrison Drive toward the steps. Wait, Tommy, what have you got?" I stopped. I waited. Tommy pulled out a linty dime and 3 pennies. "Okay, so we've got 38 cents. Trade?" I kept moving up the hill, and they knew if I hit the stairs. Once I got on the stairs, those 72 steps, and my mother could hear us negotiating, it was all over. I reached the stair. I heard, "Hanny!" "I got another quarter. 63 cents. Will you take 63 cents? "Deal." So I traded those firecrackers, put the money in my pocket, and began to imagine how I would spend that fortune. The two boys raced up the hill, up the stairs, through the backyard, over to Tommy's house. By the time I got to our backyard, they were coming back. But my brother had a piece of string, a coffee can, and Tommy had a matchbook. Now, the matchbook wasn't a surprise, but the string? "What you doing, Pilly?" He began to take all of those firecrackers and wind the string around the entire batch. "Billy, what are you doing?" Even Tommy looked a little nervous. "Shut up, Hanny. They're mine now. They're not yours." What? Wait a minute. Don't do it. Don't do it, Billy." Tommy passed him the matches. "Billy, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't be such a baby." Billy. I heard the match and I went screaming to the back door, racing out. Mama, Billy's going to kill himself. He's going to kill himself. Boom. My mother, she shot out of the house. And I waited. I waited for the sound. "What the hell do you think you're doing?" was what she said. Oh, he was alive. So I headed out of the house, and there she was. "Tommy, you go home. I'll talk to your mother later." "Okay, Billy, what were you doing?" Even he was trembling. "Lighting firecrackers?" "Where did you get firecrackers? I don't let you use firecrackers." And then a little smile stretched across his face. "Hanny sold them to me." Well, nothing needed to be said. I dug into the pocket, pulled out the coins, and passed them to my mother. And then I led myself into the house, took myself to my bed, and curled up tight under the chenille bedspread. Behind me, I could hear some arguing. "What do you mean I'm grounded tonight? I can't go to the beach fair." Mumble. "Well, if Tommy's mother lets him go, can I go too?" Mumble. Then I heard a stomp and my brother barely slamming his door. But I lay in bed, so tight, so cold. And I wished I hadn't gone to the beach that morning. And I began to wonder, had there been other kids who'd gone to the beach and found firecrackers? Where were they now? That kind of thinking made it hard to go to sleep. So I lay there, and the chenille, tufts of cotton, pressed against my cheek.
Thank you. Thank you, Johanna. Our next storyteller is Donald Small. Don lives in Castine, and he is a retired MMA professor who now spends his time on community volunteer work, woodworking, writing, and gatherings with his family. His writings include Saltwater Town and a new book due out in just a few months. He also did extensive editing on the book Margaret, a novel written by his late wife, Barry. Please welcome Don.
Thank you very much. I'd like to take you to Castine, but the year is 1948. I was 10 years old, lived with my family here. My dad was a teacher at Maine Maritime Academy, which at that time was a much smaller school. I think there might have been about a dozen faculty members, and they all lived in Castine. So that combination of small number of people all working together, all living in the same town, there were close personal ties that were established, and families gathered on a regular basis for social events. Now, I vaguely remember going to some of those. There is one, however, which is in my mind. I mean, this is nearly 80 years later, and I still remember it vividly. We gathered at the waterfront on a Saturday morning. We got in one of the MMA's boats. It was an open launch, probably about a 40-foot one. And we motored out of the harbor, past the bell buoy. And then there was a long trip. I'm not sure exactly what direction we were going in. But eventually, we approached a small village. And what we saw from the boat was a waterfront made up of a beach, and there was a pier coming out from that beach. Behind that, there was a big lawn area, and there was a road surrounding it. And outside of the road, there were a lot of houses. So the lawn area was essentially the town square or the town common. Now, what really caught my eye, my 10-year-old eyes, was on the left-hand side, the row of houses going up were small cottages. They were 1.5 story. They had steep roofs. They had gingerbread trim down the front of the, under the eaves and along the front of the roof. And they had front porches. Now, the really amazing thing about them, though, to my eye, was that they were painted a whole variety of colors. They were pastel colors. I mean, there was blue and green and yellow and orange. I'd never seen anything like that. I lived in Castine. A house is supposed to be white, and it might have green trim. And here, someone had gone completely wild, and they had these houses which were all kinds of a great rainbow of colors. You know, if it's a house, it's supposed to be white, but somebody has completely violated this. So the other thing that we saw from the boat was a group of people on the common. And as we got closer to the dock, they came down to the dock, they greeted us, they helped tie the boat up, and they escorted us back up the hill to the common. They had built a bonfire in the middle of it. There was a croquet court over on one side. There was a volleyball net set up somewhere else. And the rest of the day, the two groups of people spent a joyous, noisy time. There were games to play, there was conversation, and there was food to share. And even to a 10-year-old boy, it was really an amazing time. Two amazing things about that day. The view of this village, which almost seemed like a magical village, and the other one was this joyous event that was going on. So as an adult, I sometimes thought of that with pleasure, obviously. But there was something about it that was mysterious. I was puzzled about, where is that town anyway? I've lived on Penobscot Bay for most of my life. I've been, I thought, to most of the towns around, if not all of them, and I've never found that town with all the colored houses in it. So I began to think, maybe that didn't actually happen. Maybe it was just my imagination, or I dreamed it, or maybe we went to a town that was just an ordinary town with white houses. I don't know. I didn't understand what had happened there. Now we're going to go forward 40 years. It's 1988, And my daughter, Karen, is working for a bank, and she has recently been assigned to Belfast. She's the assistant manager of the branch there. And she talks to me about the idea, I'm going to be here for 5 years, they tell me. So what about if I buy a house rather than renting an apartment? That would seem to make sense. I agreed, and I also agreed to come up with some money for the down payment. So she called me up a short time later and said, I found the house that I think I really like, but I want you to come look at it. So a few days later, I got myself to Belfast. Late afternoon, Karen's getting out of work. We get in her car, and she drives on out of Belfast and south down Route 1. And we go several miles, and then she turns off on the to a left. And we go down a country road that I had never seen before. Fields and woods and occasional farmhouse. Eventually, we came to a long hill that was going up, a gentle slope, and in the distance, I could see the collection of houses. So I thought, oh, maybe there's a village here, and that's where her house is going to be. So we got to the top of the hill, and she stopped the car. And she said, that's the house right down there. That's the one that I like. So I glanced at that. Looks like a nice house. But I looked around at the rest of it. That's what I really looked at. And maybe you can guess what I saw. There was a big lawn area there, and there was a road that went all the way around that lawn, and there were houses around that road. And you know what? On the left-hand side, going down, there was a row of one-and-a-half-story houses. They had steep roofs. They had gingerbread trim down the sides, and they were painted pastel colors. There was green and orange and blue and yellow. So I had found that. I had begun to think that that place did not even exist, and yet here I found it. So what my story is about is that of a child finding something magical, as an adult losing it and wondered what happened to that magic, and then by pure luck, finding it again. So I can hope that for everybody, that you will all find a bit of that good magic that was part of your childhood. Thank you for listening to my story.
Thank you, Don. Our next storyteller is Barbara Cooper. Barbara and her husband discovered Castine in 1989. They fell in love with the town, and she has enjoyed all the activities the town has to offer ever since, including volunteering with local organizations like the Wilson Museum. Welcome, Barbara.
What an act to follow. Thank you, Don. Okay, I am was a part of a Navy family. My dad was a career naval officer, and in my generation, that meant World War II. So in my youth, my father was a flag on a map on the kitchen wall. Whenever my mother thought she sort of knew where he was in the Atlantic or in the Pacific, we would move the flag. And then on that same kitchen table was a stack of letters that he wrote all those years, and we would read these letters. So my dad was that flag. After the war, came home, it was a shock to him as well as us. We weren't really sure what my dad looked like. And sitting at the dinner table, my goodness, we were expected to sit up straight, eat everything he thought we should eat. And my brother at that time had a habit of always spilling his milk. And the milk would spill, and my father would pound the table and say, "You have spilled enough milk to float a battleship." And this happened all. But anyway, we were happy to be together when we went to Washington. We were there for a while. My dad had a ship during that time. But the big change in my life, in our lives, was when my dad was stationed to Hawaii. And, you know, I was a very plain vanilla kid living in a plain vanilla area of the country. And we were all excited about driving across the country, getting on a ship, and sailing off to this new duty station. Now, the exciting thing about the ship was it still was a military ship. So there weren't stairways, there were ladders. There were guns still on the ship. But most exciting of all, there was a group of sharp shooting Marines. And day and night, they were on the whatever, not the bridge, but top of the ship, and looking for mines that were still floating from Japan and Hawaii toward the West Coast. So we kids, we'd hear an alarm, we'd rush to see, the Marines would start shooting, and eventually a mine would explode. Well, this happened day and night. The kids loved it. Our parents were absolutely afraid for all those days that we would be blown up before we got to paradise. So anyway, we got to paradise. Yes, there were the palm trees. There were actually grass shacks as we sailed into Pearl Harbor. And we settled into a Navy community, not very big, where there were a lot of kids my age. And I was just on the verge of being 14. And of course, at that age, everyone wants to belong. You don't want to be the odd man out. Well, did we ever feel we were odd? We didn't have a tan. We didn't have calluses on our feet because all of our friends walked barefoot on the hot asphalt. At the end of our community was a swimming pool. At the other end, tennis courts. And it was a wonderfully warm, everyone did everything together. And my father, of course, went immediately to work. But my mother, she was the one that sort of set the tone. Wherever we would move, she made sure that we read history books about it, learned some of the language, took hula lessons, tried to do a surfboard, tried to fit in was the most thing. And then going to the school my brother and I went to, I came home one day and I was so unhappy. My mother said, "What is your problem?" I said, "My problem is I'm too plain. My hair is a straggly brown. My eyes are brown. I don't have a tan." Blah, 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 blah. Well, so I did everything to fit in. The most important thing, I realized, was to get a ukulele. And because there were no transistor radios then, and if you wanted music, at the pool you played your ukulele, at the beach you played your ukulele. And so my mother bought I think it only cost $10, but I would sit with the kids, and I'd pretend that I knew what I was doing. And after a while, I learned the 6 chords that I still know, and I can play hundreds of songs with that. The other thing, I borrowed my father's old tennis racket. He hadn't hit a tennis ball since 1938, and this was 1950. But anyway, started to play tennis at the local courts. So I became pretty proficient at tennis and the ukulele. And my mother just made sure that I had hula lessons and this and that and so forth. So that to me was, gave me the confidence. The rest of my life, I went to 3 different high schools. As long as I had my ukulele, I was in variety shows. I had my tennis racket, I was on the tennis team. And this continued through University of Texas, and my life, you know, still now is my ukulele, and 2 years ago it was my tennis racket. But just that change of venue to an imaginary, what I thought was imaginary, but a real land, gave me confidence for the rest of my life. And I hope you have the same experience someday. Right.
Barbara. This is our last storyteller before we're going to have a brief intermission, and I'll tell you a little more about that in a moment. But our next storyteller is Haley Blake. Haley is a proud member of the Wilson Museum staff team and currently lives in Bucksport with her husband and their two-year-old daughter. She enjoys reading when she can, dance parties with her daughter, the smell of the ocean, walking in the woods, and making herself and others laugh. Please welcome Haley.
One beautiful evening between my junior year and senior year of high school in the summer, I was walking down the sidewalk and found myself stopping dead in my tracks, totally overwhelmed with stress. I had just gone out to dinner with my mom and my stepdad, and it was a beautiful evening. We had boated down the river to this little place in Richmond and had gone out for pizza where my parents bantered with the owner, and we were headed back down to the boat when my mom casually mentions that I really need to start thinking about where I'm going to go to college. Which was fair, because senior year was coming, and I had to figure out what I was going to be doing with my life. But this decision, while a great one to have to make, was really overwhelming to me, and I had a hard time envisioning where I was going to go and what I was going to do, and the idea of leaving my home base was too much for me to want to think about. Whenever the topic came up, I would completely shut down. And in this instance, I was walking down the street, my feet froze, my hands clenched, my shoulders rounded, my vision narrowed, and if my insides felt like they had suddenly turned to stone, like cold, hard, heavy cement. I could not bear it. And I was especially afraid of leaving my mom and my grandmother because the three of us were like three peas in a pod. And every year in the summer, we would rent a small cabin in Deer Isle. This started when I was about 10. And it was this tiny, tiny place. It was called Kevin's Closet. Closet was in the name. And it only worked for us to stay there because I was a scrawny 10-year-old. So we rented this tiny cottage on the coast, and it was like being away at summer camp with your two best friends. We would spend the days reading together, playing games together, doing puzzles together, going for walks on the beach, and it's incredible, going shopping in town. And one of the features of this particular place, it was right on the water, so we got to see the sights and sounds of the coast of Maine. We lived, interior Maine, so this was really special to get to be on the coast and to watch the tides come in and out every day and hear the seagulls and the smells of the ocean. And in particular, my grandmother enjoyed watching the lobstermen out the window because there was a lobster pound next door. So we would hear the boats leave in the morning and get to see the lobstermen unload their boats in the afternoon. And she adorably and fondly nicknamed one of them Suntan Man, because he was constantly without his shirt trying to catch a tan. He was like 20, and so it was funny for her to strike up this one-way friendship with this guy out the window. So it was great. And even when things got tense, they weren't really that bad. Like, the worst that it got was like if I put too many pieces in my grandmother's zone in the puzzle, puzzlers will know they're very territorial. So that was a faux pas. So she would say, "All right, that's enough." And I knew I had to back off. So not too bad. Or the time where my grandmother and I stayed up late watching this incredible lightning show out over the water. And it got like pretty late. And my mom was really trying to go to bed. And she would be like, "Can you guys please go to bed? Or at least keep it down. Like, come on. It's like 11 o'clock. So not too bad. And then there was another time where we were making our way home and somehow got lost on our way. Not sure how this happened, but I didn't mind because it just meant we had more time together as the three of us, just the three of us, which was exciting. So I didn't mind, but I could tell that my mom didn't really love being lost and not knowing where we were. And this was before GPSs came out. So she's trying to navigate the roads. My grandmother's in the front seat, the gigantic Maine Atlas strewn across her lap. And she's trying to figure out where we are as we're trying to make it home. So eventually we made it home, and it was fine. But the idea of leaving this pod, like the safety of this pod and this wonderful relationship I had, was really stressful for me. And the idea of going to college felt like it was going to just disrupt like what I had known. So I kept, you know, getting really stressed about it. But eventually what kicked me out of this decision paralysis was my mom saying to me one day, you know, not making a decision is making a decision, and life is going to happen one way or another. And luckily, that actually took the pressure off. And that was fine. So I got my butt in gear, and I started looking for schools. And I found three schools that I wanted to look at. The first was Champlain University in Vermont. And it was a little farther from home than I, you know, ideally liked, but thought it would be a good, like, test me out of my comfort zone thing. So we go to the school, and we check it out. And it's good that we visited, because when we visited, I found that it really didn't feel like me. Like, it didn't feel like the place for me. It was too big. It felt impersonal. And I decided that, you know, I really didn't need my school to have a Quidditch team. Just, that was not a factor I needed. Didn't need a Quidditch team. So that one didn't make the top of the list. The second school that we looked at was the University of Farmington in Maine. So it was a little more familiar because, you know, it was in Maine. I had family who had gone there. Friends from school were going to go there. They had a good teaching program, which is something I was considering at the time. But it didn't strike me either. We visited on a gray, cloudy day, and that kind of matched my feelings towards it. Like, it's a great school, but it just wasn't for me. And then the third and final place that we visited was Maine Maritime Academy. And as we were driving to the open house, and my mom and my stepdad were in the car on our way here, it felt really familiar because it was essentially the same route that my mom and grandmother and I would take on our way to our Deer Isle vacations together. And I remembered particularly this one trip where we were driving and the one that we got lost on. And where we got lost was in the Castine Triangle. I don't know how we got lost in the Castine Triangle for as long as we did. But there were continually signs for Castine, but we didn't, like, we couldn't figure out where in Castine we were or how far it was. Like, I don't know. So that's where we were when we got lost. And oh, yep. And on that trip with my mom and grandmother in the car, when we were in the car trying to figure out where we were, my grandmother says, you know, I think the universe is trying to tell us that Haley needs to go to Castine. And this was years before I was looking for school. So I, like, was not thinking, like, I was like, what do I need to go to Castine for? Like, I don't know what you're talking about. I thought it was nice that she thought the universe was thinking of me, but but I didn't. I was like, okay. And I didn't give it too much weight until I did go to the open house, and we came across the British Canal and up the hill by the golf course and parked near Delano Auditorium. And when we got to campus, when I was standing on the sidewalk looking out at campus, I was overwhelmed with this sense of warmth and this contentedness. And I knew that she was right, that I was meant to come to Castine, and that I had found my place.
Thank you, Haley. So now we're going to have a brief intermission, and we're going to enjoy some cider and donuts in the kitchen and mingle with each other. Sign up in the kitchen if you'd like to tell a story at a future event, and we'll flick the lights in 10 minutes, and we'll come back for a couple more stories. Thank you.
You are listening to WERU Community Radio and an evening of storytelling that took place at the Wilson Museum in Castine on September 25th, 2025.
All right, now that our bellies are a little bit fuller, we're going to welcome our next storyteller, who is Keith Hagel. Keith is a former managing editor at the Sun Journal in Lewiston, a retired newspaper editor, and non-retired devil's advocate. He and his partner are tournament Scrabble players, and when not traveling to competitions, divide their time since 2014 between Castine and Colorado Springs. Every 5 years or so, he gets behind a microphone to tell a story, and it's that time again.
It was a summer afternoon a number of years ago. I was in the basement of the Witherly Library in Castine trying to sort out donations of books that maybe we could sell at a book sale. A middle-aged man walks in by himself. I don't recognize him. He's not from Castine. He's not a book dealer. Just wasn't. Okay. Hi. What do you like to read? He said, I'm a teacher. I teach high school business and economics. I said, where do you teach? Lubbock, Texas. Boom! Now, West Texas isn't exactly on my list of 1,000 places to see before I croak. Hot, dusty, humid. But I said, I've been there a number of years ago. Well, I'd met another Scrabble player, a woman. We became friends. She invited me to come visit her in Lubbock. I did. Okay. So my visitor looks at me and he said, Cheryl Tyler? Double boom. What the hell? And yeah, it was Cheryl Tyler. Okay, and what did Ed Perkins, who introduced himself, yeah, the Perkins, it's like Perkins out there, it's that Perkins family. He had grown up in Castine, loved it, tried to come back every year or two, wants to be buried here. Okay, Cheryl Tyler. Cheryl Tyler was a force of nature, a piece of work. She grew up in really dirt poor Texas, and she was dirt poor. She put herself through college, same place Lyndon Johnson went to college, put herself through medical school, had a well-respected family practice in Lubbock. She also had more interests and passions than a dog has fleas. And she had four dogs. Besides Scrabble, besides being a professional, she was a reader, a writer, an artist, a photographer, a loyal football fan, and Texas Tech fan. And that's just the beginning. But the things she liked most were the three teenagers that she had started out by becoming a foster parent, a single woman in her 50s becoming a foster parent to three teenagers in the, wow. Okay, now she adopted them, and they were making it work. And so how did Ed Perkins get involved in all of this? Well, when I came to Lubbock, Cheryl wanted me to see kinds of places and people that were important to her. And she was trying to see how I would adjust to West Texas. And I think she was also having people evaluate me and, would this guy last more than a day here? Whatever. Okay, and so Ed Perkins taught the religious education class for adults at her church that she took me to one day. Okay, so I said, I'm beginning to put the pieces together now. I said, I think I know you. He said, Keith? Oh. Now there was a teacher It had been years since he'd seen me once for an hour, and he remembered my name. I can't remember my name an hour later. Wow. Okay. It didn't work out between Cheryl and me. I think maybe it was just largely a cultural divide between this woman who was pure Texas, who loved Scrabble and was a liberal out there, and then this marginal Yankee out here who loved Scrabble and was a liberal, but that's a big gulf between, well, whatever, it didn't work out. And we sort of drifted apart. The story's not over yet, folks. Later on, a few years later, she was looking for a proofreader for one of the books she was trying to write. And I volunteered. I knew what I'd get for it, nothing. Soon I got promoted to be her editor. And soon after that, we were talking on the phone every night because I didn't like typing in editing comments. So we'd edit for half an hour, and then we'd just gab for half an hour. Cheryl was a great doctor. I saw that in the time I was in Lubbock. But she had two faults as a doctor. One was she had a bad ticker. She'd had it for decades, and she was just beginning now to really try to do something about it. And then the second thing was she had one horrible patient. Tragically, it was herself. And so one day in 2022, she called me and said, "I'm not feeling well. Let's not do it tonight." Okay. And she calls me Friday morning and says, "I still feel like crap." I said, "Okay, take the weekend off. I'm going to play Scrabble and tournament anyway." But didn't feel right to me. On Saturday morning from the tournament, I tried calling her again. No answer. Right to voicemail. In fact, that call was never opened. Cheryl was dead. She had died alone, just with her four dogs, on either Friday or Saturday. We never got to say goodbye. Cheryl was really special. And I miss her. And I haven't seen Ed or been in contact with him since then. But I told you the story's not over. Because based on doing this, I'm going to be in contact with him. And if he comes back to Castine, we're going to get together. From Lubbock to Castine with love. Thank you. Okay, let me get out of here.
Thank you. Our next storyteller is Nate Gibbons. Nate is a Marine Systems Engineering student at Maine Maritime Academy. Woo!
Can everybody hear me? Nice. All right, so for the Mainers in the crowd, not from around here, I'm sorry. I'm a part of the great invasion of the out-of-staters taking over the state. I'm originally from Hershey, Pennsylvania. I grew up in the Susquehanna River Valley. And my parents and extended family all grew up in Altoona. And Altoona, Pennsylvania is this little kind of blink-and-you'll-miss-it kind of town. think they're calling it a Rust Belt city now. It's been in consistent decline since the railroad left, but it has always held kind of a special magical place in my heart. I remember spending summers and weekends as I was growing up going to my Nan and Pap's house in Altoona. It was back Sinking Valley. It's one of those, kind of reminds you of main roads. There's these thin, winding roads that go up a mountain, and you end up in this kind of like little open clearing, and there's a house there. And then you'll go through more roads, and you'll enter another clearing, and there'll be a house there. But they had this house with a creek out front and a pond, and my grandfather had a shop down the driveway. And I remember my grandmother, it was always big for her that she had her kitchen with this massive floor-to-ceiling window so she could see out over the property. She could watch the deer, she could watch the birds, she could see what my grandfather was up to. That was always the big thing, seeing what my grandfather was up to. But I remember one day, I was about 7 years old, sitting on the little stoop in the kitchen, looking out that window, and I could see my grandfather was up to something. And that was never a good sign when my grandfather was up to something. But I could see fire, and I could see him pull something yellow hot out of the fire and start hitting it. And I knew as soon as I saw something hot, I wanted to go try it. So being the ambitious seven-year-old I was, I went down to my grandfather's shop and asked him what he was doing. And he told me he was blacksmithing. And so based off of that, I decided I was going to also become a blacksmith that day. And he pulled a hot piece of steel out of the fire and put it in the vise and told me that I could take a wrench and I could twist it. I was like, nah, you're joking. You can't do that. That's metal. Like, metal doesn't bend. Metal doesn't move like that. And I remember taking the wrench and I remember bending it and twisting it. And it moved just like clay at that temperature. And for a seven-year-old me, that was like incredible. You can move this really, really tough material in your mind that's not supposed to do that. And you can just move it like it's clay. And so fast forward a few years and I kept up with my blacksmithing hobby. I ended up joining the Pennsylvania Artists Blacksmith Association, met a lot of really cool blacksmiths who had been in it for a really long time. And then freshman year of high school came around and I thought it was about time to decide whether or not I was going to keep doing it as just a hobby or as if I was going to kind of learn a little bit more from one of the old timers. And it just so happened the old timer I learned from was the oldest timer there was, Bill Purcell, who at the time was 96, very spry for his age. Bill, he lived back Manitoba Bottom Road. Funny enough, he just missed having his house on Blacksmith Lane. He was the next lane down. But old Bill was about yay tall. He said he was a taller man when he was younger, but he kind of stooped down with age. And he would always wear, whether it was summer or winter, he would wear this winter hat that had flaps that come down his ears, and he'd put the flaps up. And we all referred to him as the Flying Nun. And he didn't like that. But I remember driving the road to Manitoba Bottom, much like Sinking Valley, and arriving at his house. It was this little cinder block, one-story ranch that he built with his own hands. And he was always adamant. He built everything with his own hands, from that house to his three shops out back, his wood shop, his machine shop, and his blacksmith shop. And so I thought, being the hotshot I was as a freshman in high school, that I was going to get right onto the forge and start blacksmithing with Bill. And I get up and I like brought my hammer, I brought my tools, and he said, slow down there, bud. We're going to start you off, man, in the fire. And his biggest quote for that was, police that fire, boy. Policing a fire in a blacksmith shop mainly refers to the fact that fires like to burn wherever there's fuel. And in the fire pot, fuel kind of surrounds the central honeycomb. And if you don't pour water over the surrounding coal, it'll spread and burn, and then you really have a useless fire that's not going to heat metal very effectively. And so that first time I was at Bill's house, I remember the fire kept on getting a little bit out of control, and he kept telling me to police that fire. Come on. Come on, boy. Police that fire. And fast forward a couple more weeks, I was getting the hang of it, and he started to let me forge under him, and that's where I learned my art of figure carving. Bill was always big into creating creatures and shapes out of metal that you really wouldn't expect to see. And a big example of this was his living room. His living room kind of served as his gallery. And I remember the one day I went and he wanted to show off all the things he had made. And I remember seeing in the corner there was an eagle made out of horseshoe rasps. And then there was little dragons on top of his fireplace. And then on his coffee table, there was a big dragon. And he says, you like that dragon? And I was like, yeah, that's pretty cool. It's an interesting kind of design that you made there. And he's like, watch this. So I'm standing in front of this dragon, and Bill starts turning knobs under the table, and all of a sudden, a 4-foot-long fireball shoots out of the front of this dragon. But as I have grown up, that police that fire boy has always stayed in my mind. That whenever life gets busy, whenever things seem crazy, I know I can always police that fire because Bill Purcell taught me how.
Thank you, Nate. So our next storyteller and our final storyteller is Tracy Lemire. Tracy works and lives in Castine. She has taught at the Adams School for more than 31 years and resides at Dice Head Light, where she raised her three children. Tracy owns a flower business and a beer garden called Devil's Half Acre, where gatherings and opportunities for connecting are relished. Please welcome Tracy.
How's that sound? Okay. Feels good. Hi. So yes, I live at the Lighthouse here in Castine. I've lived there for 13 and a half years. And interesting to be a lighthouse keeper when I come across people from away, from near and far. There are three questions that they often ask me when they see me. And the first question is, do you live in the lighthouse? And I say, yes, I do. And what's it like to be living in a lighthouse? And then the third question is, how did you get here? And that's what I'm going to share with you. I'm originally from Buffalo, New York. Go Bills. I have to say that. And the summer I turned 18 years old, I was getting ready to go to college at a local university. And I was going to commute from home. It was an easier way to do it. And my parents, after 23 years of marriage, decided to split. And mom went this way, dad went that way. And the youngest of five children, I was the only girl. And I saw that my dad, I didn't know what quite to do with Tracy. Where's Tracy going to go? Because I knew I didn't want to stay there at this and just to remove myself from it. So I sat down with my dad and I said, you know, I spent a lot of summers on Damariscotta Lake and as a child with my aunt and uncle. And it's like the on Golden Pond experience of just, this is definitely vacation land, and I kind of really like it here. But so I thought, what if I go to Maine? Why can't I just go to school at Maine? Is there any chance? School's going to start in 2 weeks. And my dad thought, you know what, that's probably a good idea. So sure enough, fast forward, 2 weeks go by, and I'm up at University of Maine. And my dad, he drops me off at college, and then he goes off to Buffalo. But it was really wonderful where I landed because in my dorm, I had dorm mates that had something in common. They all grew up together. They were like brothers of the hood or something. And I said, where you guys grown up? The stories they had were incredible. And it was this little town called Castine. And I said, I'd never heard of Castine before. And there were, you know, bonfires at the back shore that were larger than life, and there were never any police in this town. And, you know, swimming to the Bell Buoy and Ram Island weekends and just boys getting in trouble, but not really getting in trouble. So I thought it was like a never land. So I wanted to see it really badly. And so one winter day, I drove down. His name was Ben. And another thing I forgot to add is that he grew up in the lighthouse. His mother lived in the lighthouse. And so this story gets better and better. So we drive down on a winter day. It was during a winter break. And we head down Main Street. And I was like, this is beautiful. The white houses. I couldn't believe it. But what I couldn't really believe was that there was no people. There were no cars. There was nobody in these beautiful houses. And growing up in Buffalo, New York, there wasn't a summer colony. It was just you had a house and you lived in it. So it was just there was something eerie about it. Like I thought it was a Stephen King movie unfolding in front of me. Like, what is this town? So we eventually get up to Battle Avenue and head to the end of the road, and there's the lighthouse. And now we're talking a horse of a different color. It was lit up. You'd see candles in the window. There was smoke coming out of the chimney. And when I get to the door, I'm welcomed by this beautiful woman with silver hair and rosy pink cheeks and twinkly green eyes. And she's got a ladle in one hand and a wooden spoon in the other and an apron on. And her name is Nancy Carr. And come on in here. And the house was just, there was garlic bread and Italian sauce and the boiling on the stove, and the wood stove by the kitchen was on fire. It was lit up, and then there's a beautiful small fireplace in the living room, and that was glowing just as well. And so it was just this warmth, and so we was sat in our teeny tiny couch by the teeny tiny fire, and spent the great had a great night conversing and hearing more stories. So the invitation was to always return at any time and as often as I wanted, and I did. And in fact, I'm still there. I haven't left. So the years click by, and I do spend my summers with Nancy. I work beside her. I worked in Kneisel Hall with her, and life goes on. And I have children. I'm married. I get a teaching job here in this beautiful town, and my own children get to experience the joy and magic of Nancy Carr, handmade ice cream cranking on the porch, or lilac parties. You lost a tooth and another party is going to happen. And she just really just had this nice warmth to her. But it came to pass that she had to leave the lighthouse because of health issues, health reasons. So she needed to be closer to a healthcare facility. So she moves out, and I know that was not in her heart. She wanted to stay forever. And few years go by in that situation, and I visit her. She's only in Belfast, but we continue to be with each other. And I found myself becoming a single mother around this time, and I'd moved from house to house in Castine. So there was one day my kids were kind of occupied with other friends or something, and I thought, I really miss the lighthouse. I'm just going to go watch the sunset. And so I drive to the lighthouse, and at that time, the town of Castine was doing its due diligence of putting in new windows and refreshing the paint on the walls. And so I went there, and nobody was there at the lighthouse, and I just walked up the steps, and it didn't feel the same, and just really missing her. And then I look inside the window, and it's empty, and there's not a stick of furniture, and it's like, she's not going to come back. I'm not sure. And so I put my handle on the doorknob. I was really curious, and it was unlocked. Nobody had locked it. So I walked in to this empty house, and it didn't feel right. It felt a little haunting and really lonesome, and I couldn't remember. I couldn't imagine it not being so full of life. So I learned shortly thereafter that the lighthouse, the town, was actually looking for a tenant. And the next day I got in the car and drove to visit Nancy and walked into her apartment and sat on the couch beside her and just laid my head on her shoulder and said, Nancy, what if I were to live in the lighthouse? What if I were to hold this space for you when you return? And she just squeezed my hand and said, yes, you need to go there. Be the light that you always are. So I've been there ever since. And Nancy was to never return, but the light has never gone out since. So I'd like to welcome all our storytellers up here to take a bow. Yeah. I would also, just before you all head out, like to thank WERU for being our partner on this, as well as Matt, and also to thank Lizzie and invite her up here to say a few more words to you.
Thank you, and thank you, Georgia, for hosting such a wonderful evening of stories, and the Wilson Museum. And thank you to all of you for being a wonderful, wonderful audience. If any of you felt inspired by what you heard tonight to maybe like, I think I have a story, I could try that out. There is a little clipboard with a sign-up sheet on your way out on the counter where the donuts were. And it's not a commitment of any kind, but if the Wilson Museum or another, you know, local group puts on another storytelling, community storytelling show like this, then they'll be sure to get in touch with you and say, hey, what do you think of this? And I think it's important to stress, too, that nobody gets up here and does it alone. We offer feedback, and you know, it's an iterative process. It can be honestly a process of discovery that can be kind of surprising. So you're not out on a limb by yourself. All right. And thank you. Thank you so much for coming.
And I just want to add a personal thank you. Georgia and Lizzie and I have been working on this for a while and trying to get this event together for you. And it is so wonderful to see such a packed house. And I just want to say that we really, really appreciate you being here. So thank you so much.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to an event of storytelling by community members at the Wilson Museum in Castine, Maine, on September 25th, 2025. Co-sponsored by the Wilson Museum and WERU Community Radio. Special thanks to the Maine Humanities Council for generously providing a grant to fund the event. Special thanks as well to storytelling coach Lizzie Peabody and Haley Blake and Georgia Zildjian of the Wilson Museum. Thanks for tuning in.